Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Well, that's good. That's pretty good. You know, I'm not going to do the louder bit.
Good morning.
Good morning, Scott. The oral health section would like to welcome you to this session entitled Increasing Access to Oral Health Care for Persons Living with HIV/AIDS, Results of the HRSA-SPINS Multi-Site Evaluation. We invite you to become more involved in the oral health section by attending one of our business meetings, which would be next year. We would ask you to stop at our exhibit at the our booth at the exhibit hall, but I believe it's closing at 12:30 today. But we have individuals here who volunteered, and it was a wonderful experience, right?
It was
a wonderful experience. Real toothbrushes there. But you can always sign up to be part of the exhibit booth next year and attend our meetings and get involved in any committees or aspects of the oral health section by emailing any of the leadership or talking to Scott. I'd like to introduce my colleagues and co-presenters. Serena Rajavian is with the Health and Disability Working Group at Boston University School of Public Health. She's a senior evaluator at the Boston University School of Public Health on the SPINS Oral Health Care Initiative, adjunct faculty of research at the BU School of Social Work. For the past 7 years, she's been working with Ryan White-funded grantees, providing training, technical assistance, and evaluation. She has a master's degree in public health and international relations from Johns Hopkins University. Jane Fox is with the Health and Disability Working Group at the Boston University School of Public Health. She is the project director for this project that we're talking about today, the Evaluation Center on HIV and Oral Health at Boston University. I am a moderator and presenter, and my name is Helene Bednarsh. I'm director of the HIV Dental Program at the Boston Public Health Commission and a dental consultant to the SPINS Oral Health Initiative. And with that, we will begin with Serena.
Thank you, Helene. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming to our presentation. I realize it's the last day of the conference, almost last session, so we really appreciate that you're coming out to hear and learn from some of our results that we're excited to share with you about our project on increasing access to oral health care for people living with HIV. So I'm going to start, let me first say, Jane, Helene, nor I have any disclosures to present. I'm going to give you an overview of our study and talk a little bit about the outcomes that we're finding, and then Helene and Jane will go into some more of the specific outcomes. But our project was funded from the Health Resources Service Administration, HIV/AIDS Bureau, as a project of special national significance called the Oral Health Initiative. It's been a five-year project. We're in the final year of extension funding, where we're mainly looking at the results for the project. But the real goal of this project is to increase access and quality oral health care for people living with HIV. And in the study, 15 projects were funded. We call them demonstration sites. And they were innovative programs that looked at how can we expand oral health care to people who haven't had it in the past. Across the 8 programs, there were 8 rural programs and 7 urban programs. And the 15 programs used a variety of methods to expand access. Some of the strategies, we had a cohort that used mobile vans. 3 were located in urban areas and 1 in a rural area that provided dental services on the van. 7 programs used the strategy of co-locating their services with medical care so they could get people who were coming in for HIV medical care and get them referred into oral health care. 1 program was located at a dental hygiene school, and they trained dental hygiene students to deliver care to people living with HIV in specialty clinics. And then many projects used dental case managers. And I don't know how many are familiar with the way HIV services are organized, but this role in dental care was a new role where we had a person, paraprofessional, who helped patients follow up with treatment, helped them navigate, find dental specialists if they needed, maybe arrange transportation so they could come for their oral health care appointments. So those are the strategies that were employed across the 15 sites. And this shows you a little bit about where each of the projects were located. We had some on the West Coast, a couple in the South, Texas, Louisiana, Florida, North Carolina, and South Carolina. We had one project in Wisconsin, and then a few others on the East Coast. These are our multi-site study questions. I'm not going to talk about all of them today, but the ones we're going to discuss are, did the demonstration programs increase access to oral health care for the target population? We're also going to look at, are the oral health services performed in accordance with professional practice and guidelines? Do clients experience improvements in health outcomes over time? Are clients' oral health care needs met? And do clients experience improvements in oral health care related quality of life after enrolling in our projects? We also have looked at, and we're in the process of publishing, writing up and publishing our results, looking at what strategies are effective in furthering successful program implementation, reducing barriers, what helps people come into care, sort of the key lessons learned. So we're not going to present those today, per se, but we are in the process of bringing those up. So let me tell you a little bit about the study itself, the structure. The patients that were enrolled in our study had to be at least 18 years of age, so all adults. They were HIV positive, and we really focused on those who had been out of oral health care for at least 12 months. They could have received some emergency care, but they really hadn't received any routine oral health care in the past year. So we were really trying to reach those who needed the service. Our study methodology, we used a mixed methods. We had a quantitative survey, a quantitative component, which consisted of a longitudinal patient survey where we collected data at baseline 6, 12, 18, and 24 months. We collected all dental services received. So we looked at whether they had preventative care, restorative care, the whole series. We went into their charts and collected that data. And then we also collected what we called ancillary service data, which means did they get any sort of extra social support services? Did they receive transportation? Did they get food? Did they maybe have some nutrition counseling or peer support? So we also collected that data as well. Then we also did a qualitative study on the mix on a subsample of our populations because we realized, our survey could only get so much, but we wanted to find out really in depth. These were patients who had been out of care for a while, so we wanted to know what other sort of factors were influencing their oral health care seeking behavior, and we looked at their values, their attitudes, and practices towards oral health care. So I'm going to share with you mainly the results that we've found so far on our patient survey data. And in our survey, we collected data around demographics, reasons for seeking oral health care, what brought them here today, why they're engaging in oral health care, their oral health care habits and practices, their quality of life, their overall quality of life, which we use the short form 8. I don't know if any of you are familiar, which looks at physical and mental health quality of life. We looked at unmet needs for oral health care and also whether a treatment plan was completed. So we're going to be talking about some of these outcomes. And I know this slide can be a little bit hard to read, but we had over 2,400 patients enrolled at baseline in our study, and this table just shows you tells you the sites that participated as well as the number of patients that they enrolled. So they had, at each site, it was a range from 55 patients all the way up to about 290 patients that were enrolled, depending. And, of course, in the rural programs, we had smaller patients enrolled compared to the urban programs. A little bit about the demographics of the patients that were enrolled. They were majority male. Majority were born here in the U.S. 67% were minority, mainly African American or Hispanics. The mean age was 44, and it ranged from 18 years all the way up to 81 years who received oral health care services. Our patients were long-time patients living with HIV. Around the mean time was about 10 years. About a third had completed high school, and 43% had more than a high school education. So our literacy level was relatively high. This was a very engaged population in medical care. So almost 95% reported having regular medical care. 70% were taking antiretrovirals at the time of study. Almost 40% reported no regular place of dental care, had no access. And 53, more than half of our sample, had no dental care in the past 2 years. When we asked them what were their reasons for seeking care, more than half reported at least one or more problems. About 46% wanted some teeth filled or needed them replaced. Approximately one-third wanted relief of pain. Denture work and needing some sort of treatment of their gums as well. And there was about a 37% just reported that they wanted to come in for cleaning. They had not had a dentist for a while, so they needed to come in for a checkup and for a cleaning. And what was interesting about this is because that's what they reported, but then Jane will talk about some of the services they received, and that just was the reason they came in, but then there were several other problems that were also found. So some of the outcomes that I'm going to talk about. First, in looking at habits, what was sort of the impact of participating in these projects? So I'm only going to talk about the sample that we have baseline and 12 months data on. So that size is about almost 1,400 patients we have. So what we've seen, significant changes in their oral health habits, mainly on daily flossing and at least ever flossing the past 6 months, that increased significantly. We saw those who were smokers, we saw that there was actually a reduction in current smoking habits, which is quite surprising. That was not a main focus of our project, but it was something that we all talked about and tried to incorporate in our interventions. And then nutritional habits and eating practices also improved. We saw a reduction in eating candy, chewing gum with sugar, and drinking soda with sugar. In terms of symptoms, we looked at was there a reduction in the number of oral health symptoms that they had in the past year? And you'll see we found all these changes are significant. We had reductions in tooth decay, sensitivity, patients with toothache, or any bleeding gums. And then in terms of unmet need, we had, at baseline, when we enrolled these patients, 48% said they had some unmet need for oral health care. And by the end of the study, 17% were saying that they had that unmet need. And then in terms of quality of life, we looked at one measure of the condition of their teeth and gums, how they felt about that oral health quality. And that improved from 38% to 67%. So we're still looking at the data in terms of other aspects of quality of life and other outcomes. But so far what we're seeing is that these projects and having continuous regular access to care and being able to come back and is helping these patients improve their oral health quality of life as well as reducing symptoms. So I'm going to turn it over to Jane.
We're going to take a few questions now. If anybody has any questions on what we've done, we'll take more, of course, at the end after you've seen the more broad spectrum. But yes, please.
Yes. So the question was, did we do anything around cost effectiveness of this program and cost benefits? And also, I'm sorry, sir?
And mobile clinics as a known expensive way of delivering care.
And there's some literature in the past that mobile clinics are expensive, so why did we incorporate those interventions? And so first of all, Jane,
want to talk about cost.
Helene and Jane will address the cost issue. And then in terms of the mobile clinics, we at BU did not, we were the multi-site evaluation center. So I should have started off by, HRSA funded 15 demonstration sites and then us as a multi-site evaluation study to look at the impact. So the projects that applied, we didn't have control over their interventions, so they were the ones that they felt having a mobile clinic would be the best way to increase access to care, either because of limited dental providers in their area, the needing additional office clinic space. So it was not our decision to make, but what they felt would be the best way to deliver care to their populations in need, and they could serve a variety of communities. But
let's answer that too. Is there anyone from HRSA in the room?
We need to talk in the microphone.
Oh, yes, sorry.
You want to come up here?
So it was my understanding when this was first funded that HRSA was really leery about implementing any sort of mobile dental units exactly for that reason. But since this was a demonstration project, they went ahead and let that happen. There currently is a paper underway that will be published hopefully in the spring looking at the pros and cons. We did not do a cost effectiveness piece of this project because we were not, how can I nicely say this, we were not funded to do that at the get-go. HRSA had contracted with another agency to go ahead and do a complete cost effectiveness of these interventions. And it kind of bottomed out. So we are trying to do something a little bit retrospectively looking at cost, and that will be coming out later as well. But there is a paper looking at the mobile units, and I think what we found, and we can talk a little bit more later, is that as far as care goes, it is. It's a very expensive adventure to move into that. And you're really limited by, you're in this small space, you can only provide so much care to so many people, and if your driver is sick, your dentist is sick, your hygienist is sick, you're shut down for the day. And when you're looking at a study where you want to retain patients in care, you're bringing them in, you're giving them free care, when they're losing appointments that they're ready to come to, that had a huge impact on keeping people in care. And so there's so many factors that are tied to it, and I think, you know, I hate to say it's not the way to go, but it was a very challenging way for those four sites to go. And of the four sites, there's really only one remaining that is currently using their mobile unit, which is a sad, sad thing to say at this point.
And that's given that the Oral Health Initiative ended August of this year. I just want to make two comments. I want to make one quick comment in terms of cost, just to follow up with what Jane had said about, you know, it being outsourced. And what we would like to do and we're attempting to do, and this is similar to a presentation on the brush biopsy of using dental fees from like Delta Dental, Medicaid, and various stuff. We're trying to look at our utilization codes and a range of fees, but we're not doing that for a cost-benefit analysis as much as to help programs anticipate if they were to add a dental program to their existing Ryan White services, what they may expect to plan for in budgeting. Not necessarily their actual budget, but to help in budget guidance. And that is something that we're in the process of doing right now since we have all the dental codes. One thing that I should mention, for those of you who are not familiar with special projects of national significance, these began in the early 90s, a couple of years after the Ryan White Care Act was passed. And they were created to be innovative models that could be replicable and sustainable, and this oral health initiative is the first oral health initiative through the SPINS projects. So to us it was, you know, really critical and really important to capture as much data, and it is the largest data set since HCSIS. So I hope that's answered the questions you have so far, and we're going to have Jane come up.
So, as Serena said, we also, in addition to collecting the baseline and the follow-up patient interviews, we collected every CDT code for every patient that walked into the dental clinic, as well as some information about that clinic visit. Was it a scheduled visit? Was it an emergency visit? Who conducted the work that day? So we have some additional clinic data. And then we did conduct some qualitative surveys with a subset of 60 patients to gather additional information about their experiences. And as you will see, we'll get to that. So when we look at and we ask them, when was your last dental visit? You know, less than 2 years ago, almost half of the population hadn't been in care for 2 years. And 36% said that their usual source of dental care, they didn't have any, with an additional 31 saying that it was a private dentist office. Now, part of what I'm doing as the project director is thinking all along, but now in this last extra year, thinking of things we could have done differently and to help create some lessons learned around the evaluation. The one thing that we didn't ask that in retrospect would have been very helpful is under this usual source of dental care, we should have asked something like, what was your last dental visit for? And I would suspect, looking at the information that we have, I would theorize that it was an emergency visit because of what we found subsequently with symptoms and with some of this unmet need data. So, a little lesson learned. So we asked a series of questions using the Jones and Crescent scale. We did not use the OHIP for Oral Health Quality of Life. But the main indicator was describe the health of your teeth and gums. So at baseline, here we have 30% saying fair, and then another 33% saying poor. That's pretty shocking for a group of people coming into care. You know, it matches that they have this unmet need. It matches that they haven't been in care, but that they're walking around with a mouth that they're feeling is not healthy. Now, what was interesting is when you correlate that with, we asked questions from the SF8, and kind of this is the key overarching question, rate your health in the past 4 weeks. So here we have 75% who are saying, huh, it's good or very good. So there's this disconnect. I mean, this disconnect of, hey, you know, my health is pretty good, but what's going on in here has nothing to do with this overall piece, which I find incredibly interesting with this population. And I think part of it is because we had an older HIV savvy, so to speak, population who had been in care, who were very active in their medical care, who are on antiretrovirals. So, you know, when they think health, they just think, yeah, my HIV's under control, my body's under control. But this concept of your mouth as part of your overall health just does not connect. So we asked two questions that that were interesting. Serena touched on the first one. What brings you here today? So what we let the sites do was they could do the full interview within 30 days prior to the patient coming in. Now, what ended up happening was most of the time people had their interview that same week or actually that same day. Then there were three questions that were asked the minute that the patient hit the chair, and the main one was, what brings you here today? So this is symptoms that were asked in the past 12 months. Did you have any of these symptoms? And, you know, they could choose as many as they want. So we have 52% saying, yeah, I have some sort of cavities, some tooth decay going on. Half, you know, 51, saying I have sensitivity. 50% were dissatisfied with their appearance. 43% had toothache, 36 with bleeding gums. Only 10% of this sample reported no symptoms in the past 12 months. And the mean number was 3.4. So on average, people came in with three of these symptoms. Let me quickly go off on a little tangent about dissatisfied with parents. So I've done some additional analysis around this dissatisfaction with parents. My first, and I will be completely candid, my first thought was, you know, we live in this world in America where there's bleaching, there's orthodontia, there's all these things about how your mouth should look, and is this just a vanity piece? But when I went back and I did some of the analysis, and I looked at some of these other symptoms that they have as well as an unmet need, as well as how long they've been out of care, and then also looking at what was actually provided to these patients, they seriously were dissatisfied with their appearance for a reason, which kind of leads me to think, well, these guys are really engaged in medical care. One of the things that Serena didn't mention was about 85% of these people have an HIV case manager, which means they have a person that they are intimately connected to for their HIV care who helps them access care and access services. We asked them, has your HIV case manager referred you to dental? And about 75% of the time they said yes. So here we have patients who are hooked in with a case manager who's referring them to dental, but they're obviously not, you know, not making it. They have these symptoms and they're dissatisfied with appearance. And so it kind of makes me think about this whole service structure that we've built in HIV. That what is it on the case management side that they're not getting into dental? And I think that it's probably on a broader scale, too, of as providers, we give a referral, but we never know if they make it there. You know, so at what additional efforts need to be made to make sure that someone actually follows through with that referral? Thank you for my little tangent on that. So looking at that question of what brings you here today with the symptoms. So those folks that came in and on that what brings you here today, and they said, I just need a cleaning. So that's presented for a cleaning versus what brings you here today, I've got something going on and I have a problem. So it's interesting that even though you have patients who are presenting for cleaning, when you ask about their symptoms in their past 12 months, look at tooth decay, it's over 40%. Appearance, again, they also have issues with their appearance at over 40%. Sensitivity, you know, reaching about 45. So that concept of even though a patient may say, I'm just here for a cleaning or I'm just here for a checkup, there's all this underlying stuff going on. They've had these symptoms. And what I don't know, and this is kind of another little learnable, teachable moment, is what is it that makes them think, I'm just here for a cleaning? Is it a literacy piece that they're not thinking that, I've had this going on and maybe I need to explain this to the dentist? Or is it just we've, as a society, been really good about teaching people you go to the dentist for a checkup, you go to the dentist for a cleaning. So that's the verbiage that they know to show up with. Just an interesting thing. So we're going to be looking more into this for future publications, I'm sure. So what did they get? So you'll notice that our population number has dropped. we had 2,178 patients with 14 sites that actually had service utilization. We had an issue with one of the sites tied to IRB where we could not use their data, which was really unfortunate. But regardless, we still have a good sample here. Patients made over 15,000 clinic visits. They received over 37,000 services. And 42% completed a phase one treatment plan. Again, another learning, teachable moment. We did not collect the treatment plans, which in retrospect, we should have. That would have made our study so much stronger. So if you look at the first 12 months of care, every patient had a clinic visit, at least one. 33% had their phase one treatment plan completed within the first 12 months of care, and 89% had a comprehensive exam. So looking by service type, you know, this isn't, I can't imagine this is anything surprising to you folks who, you know, live in the dental world. 99% had diagnostic treatment, 69 had preventative, 55 had restorative, periodontal, 26 had some prosthodontics, some removables, and then 14 for endodontic. 90% of our patients had a comprehensive exam, 51% had patient education, and 33% had extractions with some other stuff thrown in. So the ones that got away, even in a project where your care was free, many sites had enhanced interventions with a dental case manager. There was a lot of patient education going on. Patients were constantly reminded of their appointments in a setting where there's a study going on. So they're actually getting a lot of contact from study staff as well. We had 310 patients that had only one visit, and then they were lost to care, or lost to follow-up, excuse me. So we broke it down to look at retention in care. And we defined retention as two or more dental visits at least 12 months apart during an 18-month period. So we really wanted to see what it was about those patients that stayed in. 18 months, it's a decent amount of time to see if patients stayed in care. And so what we found was that 40% of those patients came in for preventative care. 64 of that group were then retained in care. Those that were retained in care, of course, they were more likely to have completed their treatment plan. They were more likely to have a recall visit. They reported less pain and fewer symptoms at follow-up. We would hope so. But the factors significantly associated with retention, the biggie here is patients who received patient education were six times as likely to be retained in care. So those that reported having a person, well, and actually it wasn't a report from the patient, it was a report from the CDT codes, but those who had that one-on-one education piece were more likely, vastly more likely to be retained in care. See? And that would be three or more contacts. Oh, you know what? Hold on. So let me just tangent again real quickly here. So we also talked a little bit about this concept of dental case management. So many of our sites put in place this dental case manager who served as kind of the liaison between the care and the patient. They helped with transportation. They helped with reminders. They helped folks get into specialty care if they needed it. Although we looked through analysis and did not find that increased retention, there were a lot of confounding factors, and the basic confounding factor was that we had a study going on. So, of course, we had study coordinators who were trying to get these patients back in to keep them in the study to do their follow-up visits. But what we did do is then we broke it down by number of encounters. And so those patients in a dental case management setting who had more than three encounters were more likely to be retained in care. So again, it's that, for me, what it seems to be coming back to is kind of that personal touch, having that one person who's there to sit down and explain things to you, whether it be patient education with the hygienist or the dental assistant, or this dental case manager who's helping you to navigate this system. It's that, just that little extra personal touch to keep people in care. So part of the qualitative piece that we did was asking patients about their values around dental care. Tell me about your dental care as a child. Tell me about your dental care as an adult before you were HIV positive. And we found that we had about 13 patients who reported no routine dental care as a child. I very rarely go. I was not a regular client at the dentist because my parents only took me to the dentist once in my life. And so I didn't know the need for follow-up dental, you know, keeping a good hygiene program until I got older. So this concept of, this is what I grew up with. I never knew that I really needed to follow up and be a regular patient in a dental setting. versus the 11 patients that reported regular dental care as a child. I used to go regularly, like every 6 months for the teeth cleaning, and then if something came up, I'd get that taken care of. That was just something my parents instilled in me. But when you don't have dental insurance, it makes it a little harder coming out of pocket. So here we also had this group of patients who said, yeah, I grew up with that, but when it comes down to it, I just can't afford it. And then we took and did a follow-up interview, and we had 30 of our patients, 30 of the 60-ish? 40. So 40 of the 60 we did a follow-up interview with at 1 year later after they had been really engaged in care. Now that I've gone to the dentist and I've had dentures put in, I can breathe better, I sleep better, I'm able to chew food, I feel better, and it has helped my appearance and improved my health quite a bit. I was paranoid about my teeth for a long time, how I could eat, fearful stuff would fall out. I was very stressed prior to coming here and getting my teeth fixed, relieves my overall stress. I'm a bartender by trade, so my looks count in making a living. I haven't been able to work since my teeth have been like this. I want to work bartending, and having dental care is going to make it possible, whereas it wouldn't be. So folks, overall, when we did the follow-up interviews, really reported this change in their quality of life and their quality of their dental care, and they enjoyed, they really appreciated and valued what they got. And I think for a small amount of patients, and probably for more, even though we didn't get a lot of interviews out of it, these are folks who now understand the value of dental care and hopefully will stay in if, in fact, there are still abilities to cover it or make it low cost for them to stay in. So the stay tuned here for me is we have a lot going on. We are currently in the process of putting together an entire supplement with public health reports that will be on this initiative. It's coming out, hopefully, in April. We're also putting together a lessons learned manual, which is really going to be for Ryan White Clinics, community health centers who would be interested in incorporating dental care into their clinics settings, kind of the how-to manual. We have papers on oral health-related quality of life that are coming out, retention, this whole SF8 quality of life piece. There's a paper right now in process around the dental case management. I talked about the one on the mobile vans. And then there is going to be a white paper coming out on these cost estimates. As Helene said, not necessarily what's the cost effectiveness of these projects, but how can clinics learn to budget for this and what can they expect to pay for care. Any questions? I know that was a lot of stuff.
We can take some questions now. And would you, Jane, also mention the website about the videos and the Jeopardy? So
yes.
So people are interested in
so that. We also in... I don't know if there's a jump drive here. If we have time. We also produced four digital stories, working with three of the sites, and then we have one that's just Echo-wide, project-wide, where they each site found a few patients who were willing to share their experiences. They did a great series of videos with these three patients about what their lives were like before getting into the program. There's one gentleman who is just so endearing who talks about how he couldn't eat, he couldn't breathe, his mouth was a mess, and the after pictures of him are just amazing and how pleased he was with the care that he received. And then we've also put together a training module for case managers, dental case managers, some folks have actually used it out in training clinic staff about the importance of HIV and oral health. It's got a great little Jeopardy game with it, very interactive. So we have all of the slides with that as well, and then also the training modules. And so our website, which I don't know why I didn't put it up there, sorry about that, is www.hdwg.org/echo. And you can get all those materials there as well. So if we have time at the end, I do have one of those digital stories that I can attempt to plug in and see if we can get it to work. So any questions? And I'll pass this on to Helene. Yes.
I
Yes, so we have eight programs. Oh, sorry. What was the distribution of the sites across the United States? So there were 15 sites funded. Eight were rural programs, seven were urban. We had two in San Francisco, one in Eugene, Oregon, one in rural Texas, New Orleans, Miami, North Carolina, South Carolina, Massachusetts, two in New York, Green Bay, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and USVI, the Virgin Islands. Like going around.
That was
rural states more likely to use mobile dental units than those located in urban areas?
No. So the only of the four mobile dental units that we had, the only one that was rural was South Carolina, and they, you know, they did the best job they possibly could with what they had, and they traveled miles. But as I said before, they were one of the sites that had such challenges with, you know, you have one driver, the driver's out, the van doesn't go out. They also had a huge workforce issue in hiring a dentist that would stay on. So they would get a dentist, they'd get all these appointments set up, we're going to get the van going, and the dentist left. So again, here's this population that we're trying so hard to engage and retain, and we're, oh, sorry, the van's not coming today. It was very, very challenging. So the other three sites that had mobile units were New Orleans, Miami, and New York City in the Bronx, which was an interesting...
Parking in the Bronx.
Oh, man, parking, yeah. Parking these things, leveling them, driving with sensitive equipment. I mean, this is super sensitive equipment, and you're going to put it into a mobile unit and drive it through New Orleans. They were constantly having equipment problems because they could not secure the equipment well enough to drive. The amazing thing that the van, the unit driver in New York does, and I give this guy kudos every time I mention it, he saved all the original packaging. So literally he gets there an hour before, unloads everything, but when he leaves, he packs everything back up. So it's all packed and wrapped in. All the styrofoam, nothing moves. And it's a beautiful unit, and they've done a beautiful job at keeping it up and running. But the effort to keep these things running, plus all of the other effort of dealing with wastewater, dealing with sterilization, dealing with all of these other things that have to be done, is phenomenal. It's a big challenge.
If we have other questions, my presentation will be brief, and we will show you one of the digital stories after.
Yes.
I have a question about treatment of the patient. Like, so when you get to the patient who needs specialty, like, do you have a team of specialists that you refer out?
Yeah, so what sites had to do is they had to come up with specialists in the community to refer to. So that, again, was another almost barrier for folks. So you get them in, you know, do your initial workup with them, and it's like, oh, well, you need this specialty care, so we're going to refer you to so-and-so over here that's not necessarily related to the project. But they're the referrals that we have. What Miami did was they really used their van as a triage center, and so they parked it outside of their facility for part of the time, would see patients there, and then they would walk patients into the main clinic for specialty care. But yeah, it's a huge challenge. And then it's a challenge in, you know, think of rural South Carolina, finding a specialist who's going to see people. It was tough. It was really tough for a lot of these folks.
Howard?
I missed the very first part of the previous presentation, so it may have been explained about barriers in terms of cost. As you mentioned, in passing, continuing the care might depend upon the cost of care. And so could you speak to the cost factors? Mm-hmm. In the area, and how are the specialists referred to
So the question is around cost. I'm catching on. how was care paid for? How were dentists reimbursed, and how were specialists reimbursed? So since this was a HRSA SPINS project, they got a lot of money for 5 years to build this project and pay for staff. So the majority of places gave free care for the HIV populations. Dentists were hired specifically on this project and well within the pay scales of the average of the area. I think where things were a little sketchy and difficult was when it came to specialty care. A few sites actually had formal MOUs with a specialist where they had set a reimbursement rate. They send the patient to the specialist then bills the program, and it's taken care of. There were some sites that did not have those things in place and really relied upon either the philanthropy of the specialist to provide low-cost care or other foundation money to cover some of those costs, or in states where they had it, Medicaid coverage. I'm specifically thinking of San Francisco at the time. One of the sites had great relationships with some specialists where they could get things covered through Medicaid, not so much anymore. So then when you think about sustainability, we really worked with these sites from the get-go about how are you going to sustain this in the long run. And certainly in 2006, it was like, well, you know, if we have Medicaid coverage, we're going to bill Medicaid as much as we can. A few of these sites did a great job of working with their other Ryan White partners in the state. So each state gets Ryan White funding through Part B. And so they worked with the state to get some funding. They also worked with HRSA to get some Part F reimbursement funding to keep their project going. There are also some projects, thinking again of San Francisco, one of the projects did really well in working with their EMA to get some funding to continue their project. I think those that have sustained their project beyond September 1st were the ones that worked very hard from the beginning thinking about sustainability and how can we keep this going. You know, here we are year one, but how can we plan to keep this going 5 years down the road? And who also had a truly innovative model. The model that happened in Oregon, which was working with a dental hygiene school, really did a great job in selling it to this hygiene school. Well, look, we're bringing you patients. Your students are getting some great education in working with these patients. But then that was one of those places that was very good at building up MOUs with specialty care as well. So those folks that were innovative out the gate tended to be much more successful in sustaining this in the long run. The funding has now ended, and with Ryan White in the position that it is with healthcare reform, and it's up for reauthorization in 2013, it's a big question as to where funding will go, and will some of that, you know, we're hopeful, of course, that some of that funding that has been traditionally put into the medical care system for HIV patients can be shifted to some of these wraparound services that are not being picked up, dental care being number one. Because it is seen through Ryan White as a core component of medical care, and it's not. It traditionally has not been getting that funding. Was there one more question, or are we?
We can take more questions at the end as well. No, we have time. We intentionally underdid slides, knowing that we all talk a lot, well, except me, of course. Oh, you be quiet. I'm going to tell David on you. So, I am going to talk about, and I really hate to use the term performance measures. I am so, happy Jay Friedman is not in the room. Don't you call Jay and tell him I said that, because I've had these discussions with him for 5 years. So one of our really important questions for the multi-site evaluation was to answer the question, were oral health services provided in accordance with professional practice guidelines? Okay, how many in this room think that's an oxymoron? what are these guidelines anyway? And it's been more than three decades since folks like Jay Friedman, Max Shane, and many others proposed having performance measures, having some type of guidelines as to the delivery of dental care. And we'll tell you what we have and we don't have. I heard somebody mention this morning they kept doing the wrong side of the clicker, and I was trying to be cognizant of that, and I am doing the wrong side of the clicker. So when we began this project in 2006, and we did the literature search, and we went looking for any types of standards of care models or performance measures, most of it was proprietary information held at an insurance company. It was very difficult to find what we thought we needed to answer that question. After we set our standards of care, which are coming later, you know, I'm a little bit out of order, but that's who I am. In the past 2 years, HRSA had released two different sets of measures. One is called the National OPR Clinical Measure, which is the Office of Performance Review. And these are very similar. And this was the a measurement that looked at the percent of patients that had a comprehensive or periodic recall exam and for whom phase one treatment was completed within a 12-month period. That came out first. And then the HRSA, HIV/AIDS Bureau Performance Measure for Oral Health, followed. The HIV/AIDS Bureau has sets of performance measures across all the types of services funded by Ryan White. And when my colleagues talked about case management, for example, and the percent having a case manager and referring to dental care, there isn't a specific performance criteria within their performance measure that says, did you ask if they have a dentist, did you refer? It's bundled into ancillary services. Although states and eligible metropolitan areas, or EMAs, that get Ryan White funding can add additional performance measures. But this was the first of the oral health performance measures, and it was in about the second set of measures that was released. And you can see the similarity, and it was the percent of patients who received an oral exam by a dentist at least once during the measurement year. The evidence of a dental medical history, dental treatment plan, oral health education, periodontal screening or exam, and the completion of phase one treatment. So phase one treatment, this definition is standard across those two measures and pretty much ours, is prevention, maintenance, and or elimination of oral pathology that results from dental caries or periodontal disease, and includes a basic core level of services. So restorative services, some very basic perio, maybe, you know, quadrant scaling, periodontal maintenance, but definitely non-surgical perio services. Some basic oral surgery, more like the simple extraction and not the surgical extractions. Biopsy, non-surgical endodontic therapy, space maintenance, tooth eruption, and guidance for transitional dentition. So when we talk about completion of phase one, looking at that amongst our sites, how many completed phase one treatment, we didn't look at measurement years. We didn't look at within what period of time. We were more concerned with, was it done and accomplished, and the barriers, challenges, and successes in that. So what our approach was really to ask three questions. Did the patient receive what we considered, and I'm saying we because this is not a professional standard or necessarily even evidence-based, and I'm really sorry to say that, but that should be my only disclosure probably. But it was a consensus basis to be a basic standard of care. And we looked at what we thought constituted a basic standard, a baseline level of care to which you then would build upon and know at least a select services were done to determine where you went forward. And that was, you know, at least a comprehensive exam, x-rays, prophy, periodontal services. Was phase one treatment completed? And yes, we did not have the treatment plans. And in hindsight, it would have been excellent, but in having done chart audit at sites, it may have been just we would have needed about 5 years carryover. You all know little notes in chart records and how things are charted, and our philosophy in chart audits was, if the code's not there, it wasn't done. We were really strict in terms of validating our data, which I'll get to. So it wasn't whether or not phase one treatment was completed within a year of your initial visit. It was, we wanted to see if phase one treatment could be completed. And you have to understand, too, many of the patients coming in with the number of years of neglect and the number of services per patient, it may have been impossible to complete phase one treatment within a year. And also, as was mentioned, did the patient return for at least one recall visit after phase one treatment was completed? And they may have had in their treatment planning phase one, two, and three level of services, but we were looking for just at least a recall visit to know that there was a level of retention. To us, that was a signal of retention. So our utilization data are the dental codes, and they were entered by the sites for each dental visit into a web-based entry dental data entry system, which worked very well for some sites, not so well for others, and not well at all for some. And so there was a lot of training and technical assistance by the three dentist consultants and the one hygienist consultant. Who would be me? And a lot of that was the way people did business. So perhaps the dentist went in and took a couple of PAs, maybe some bite wings, and did an exam. And so when the visit was recorded, you have a choice of exam codes it could have been. So exam. So often people took the first code, the 0120, the recall exam, and entered that as an exam when it was a comprehensive exam. And this is what we found out in chart audits, some of which took 12-hour multiple days to go through and decipher. I don't recommend volunteering to do chart audits. But that's my personal opinion. Like, Jane could go off on a tangent. Don't get me started on that one. So, but what we were looking for, and we really wanted to see, was the presence of a comprehensive exam. To have that baseline level of knowledge on the head and neck, hard and soft tissues, the true oral health needs that were coming in versus what the reported chief complaint was. But the true needs. The presence of any x-rays. And we had some people, edentulous, semi-edentulous, and fully dentate. The presence of any cleaning or periodontal work. And we'll get more into some of this in the standards of care and eliminating, you know, how we eliminated those that might not have been able to have any cleaning or perio. And the presence of one recall exam after a comprehensive exam. So phase one treatment plan completion was noted in the patient chart at the site, by the sites, and entered in the web-based system. So we had our, and I'll show you the codes we chose as our standards of care, but we also asked the sites to report in the web-based entry when phase one treatment was completed. We knew they'd be placed on recall because we'd see the presence of a recall exam. And then, as I said, chart audits were conducted by at every site by the consulting dentists and hygienists to identify and correct errors or missing data. And so for, I can use a great example, and some of you in community-based programs might see this. One of the programs would just enter in the chart prophy visit. Now to them, you know, a prophy visit meant they took a full series of x-rays, they did a comprehensive exam, they did a fluoride treatment and the prophy. But it just said prophy visit, and there were no codes listed or codes in the electronic dental record or anything. So we couldn't accept anything more than a 1110 prophy. If it wasn't entered, it just didn't happen. We really wanted our data to be clean and complete. So while we talked about the overall sample size, the sample size in looking at those who we could report on standards of care for was reduced to 1,718, which excluded 20% of patients who had received full dentures within the first year, that was 152 people, or who only came for one visit, as Jane mentioned, those who got lost and missing, which was 308. So our sample size of 1,718, of those, 73.8% received what we considered to be a standard of care amongst the SPINS programs. And who was more likely to receive these? Those that were younger, more recently diagnosed, in better physical health, their housing was stable, they were high school graduates, they were employed, and they hadn't identified IDU as their measure of exposure. What I think is important to understand about oral health care amongst a population living with HIV is very often we're lower on the ladder. The person has to access medical care. The person needs to access antiretroviral therapy. They have to access housing. And then once those criteria are met, it's, oh yes, my teeth. And we see that anecdotally, and I'm hoping maybe we can make more measurements on that. The factors that were not associated with the receipt of a standard of care was if the care was delivered on a mobile van, whether it was urban or rural. Gender, race, place of birth made no difference. CD4 count or viral load made no difference. Mental health status made no difference. The use of crystal meth or the length of time to travel. Things that we would have anticipated would have made a difference did not make a difference. One piece of paper. But in our standards of care, what we were looking at, the most important was the comprehensive exam and the x-rays. The codes that we did look at were all examination codes highlighting the 0150 comprehensive exam. We looked at all codes for x-rays from a single PA through a full mouth series. We looked at all codes, prophy, quadrant scaling, full mouth debridement, periodontal maintenance as the evidence in terms of preventive care. So that was our core standard of care. So if an individual received those services, of which 73.8% did, we considered it meeting the standard of care that we came to by consensus. So receiving that standard of care was significantly associated with the completion of phase one treatment, and you can understand that. You had the exam. We know the presence of patient education, the retention in care. It was also significantly associated with retention in care with, as Jane defined, and I believe Serena defined, at least two visits at least 12 months apart during the study period. And also, but lesser so, with the receipt of patient education. Having received the standard of care was also significantly associated with better overall quality of teeth and gums at baseline, and it was associated with greater improvement in the overall health, oral health, at 12 months, but it was not statistically significant. And so, what I'd like to do is take questions on this, if you like, now, and we can show you the digital story and open up for any discussion. Howard, yes?
Sorry, just to ask a question. So, one of the things I do as a dentist is to, first of all, ask, are you here for comprehensive care, or do you just want your current problem fixed? And because I'm not going to waste my time if they're not going to come back. And, well, so
or 9110.
Yeah, and so aren't you kind of selecting those that are going to be compliant with standard of care because you're excluding the...
Oh, no, we're in... We examined emergency visits, and we're examining them on their own, and they're reported on either the 0140 or 9110. But as our standard of care to look for comprehensive delivery of care to actually increase access to care in a comprehensive level, we didn't want it to be emergency care in those. But we have tracked and looked at emergency care, and then we're looking at, you know, if you came in for an emergency visit, did you return? And many of those who never returned and were removed from this sample were those for the one emergency visit. But we have all that data. We're just not reporting it here today. Jane, you had a question.
I had a question. If you're going to make any comments in any of your publications about the lack of use of diagnostics,
we would like to, and I'd like to acknowledge, as I did on my first slide, and I should have then, Carol Tobias, who's the PI on this, and worked together with me on these slides. We're looking more into that because we do have some additional data than what we've reported today, and we'd like to take a look at other factors that influenced, you know, the completion of phase one, retention of care, and do standards of care make a difference, and what's out there other than the two federal measures, which I mentioned earlier. Thomas.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, in terms of loss of follow-up, did you do any analysis as to why they initially presented for treatment, and you know, the specific problem of routine screening and any other types of evaluation about those that you lost?
It was up to, I'm sorry, about those lost to follow. It was the site's responsibility. We are the evaluation center. We couldn't really tell the sites what to do, how to do it, other than the types of data that we were required to collect to answer our questions, and Jane or Serena may want to add to this. So if they chose to follow up on those who dropped out or missed appointments, various things like that, it was up to the site and, you know, sometimes reported to us or not. So that was site-specific, and we could only evaluate the data coming in.
But, yes, we will be looking at that group of people who fell out of care. And it's not coming to me right now what we've looked at thus far. But, yeah, what is it about that 310, those 310 people? Is it site-specific? Were these sites that had a dental case manager? What things were in place for them to hopefully not fall out, but they fell out anyway? And you're right, what were their presenting problems? And we also asked questions about substance abuse and mental health, and were any of those things tied in?
And did they move? Did they die? Very, you know, there are certain obvious factors that we can look at. Scott.
With the high percent being dissatisfied with their appearance, did you notice any change in, like, employment? Or was this going on right in the middle of the recession? Did it just not really have any impact?
So one of the things that...
Repeat the question, please.
I could remove the mic. Sorry.
So to the question about dissatisfaction with appearance and employment... one of the things that tipped me off on this dissatisfaction of appearance were the first set of qualitative interviews that we did. And there was a small cohort of folks that really talked about, I'm unemployable. I'm isolated. I don't leave my house because I feel like I can't eat in public. I can't talk to people. They're looking at my mouth. I don't want to go to church because when I sing in the choir, people are looking in my mouth. But this whole concept of employment, there were quite a few folks that talked about that. And I've looked in my doing my analysis of those that were dissatisfied with appearance and kind of crossed it with the employment. And unfortunately, when we look at employment in this population, only about 25% are employed. We have another 30-ish percent that are unemployed and another probably about 35% that are unemployed and on disability. So it could be tied to that. It could be also part of the recession issue. I think regardless of whether or not it's tied to a recession, these people feel horrible and they feel isolated and they feel, even aside from employment, that they don't want to engage in the general population. But I think that it's really tied to employment. You know, of course they're not going to, they don't want to go out and look for a job. There was a gentleman in one of our interviews who said he was employed as a waiter at a very nice restaurant, and somehow he chipped a tooth, front tooth. And it affected him and impacted his kind of mental health to the point where he ended up losing his job. And he went on to say, you know, now I drive a forklift because I can't work out in the public with missing partial of my tooth, which is so obvious for us that this needs to be fixed. And it's so obvious for him, but he just couldn't get it fixed. I know.
Jane,
when you're talking about the some of the barriers with the dental band,
yeah,
are you also going to be talking about some of the challenges of fixed clinics and facilities that, you said that sometimes it was hard to get a dentist that would stay on, but similar challenges were faced by the...
Yeah, so in our lessons learned document that we're writing, we're really going through site by site, issue by issue of work, looking at workforce issues, looking at barriers, looking at
delivery systems,
exactly. Looking at, some of them are just sheer physical location of patients don't want to go to a hospital dental clinic, but they'll go to, X clinic over here that's more confidential or not set up as a, HIV dental site. I think one of the other things that that is really interesting that we're looking at is this concept of providing some sort of ancillary services. What small things can be done in a clinic, and they don't have to be huge, but it is as small as some folks are employing texting. So you're texting your patient, or someone's texting the patient saying, don't forget you have an appointment tomorrow. Is there anything we can do to help you with transportation? Or you were in 2 days ago. I just want to check up on you to see how things are going. Did you get that prescription filled? Do you have any questions? And it's really those little human touches that seem to be the ones that are keeping folks in. And it doesn't have to be huge. And so trying to report out some of those small things that can be done.